Welcome to In the Moment. Paul Dean Jensen spent 20 years in prison serving life without parole for a murder he committed in 1996 at the age of 14. In June, a judge reconsidered that penalty and imposed a 200-year sentence with parole eligibility in 2021. Now Jensen is appealing that second sentence. He says the sentencing judge abdicated his responsibilities to the parole board. The South Dakota Supreme Court will consider this case on briefs during its March term. SDPB's Victoria Wicks has this report.
Penalties for felons who were juveniles when they offended have undergone significant changes since Paul Dean Jensen went to prison. Two recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions in particular affected his situation. The first one is Miller v. Alabama, issued in 2012. Justices ruled that juvenile offenders tried as adults can no longer be given a life sentence mandated by state law. They have to be able to argue for less. Justices said these juvenile felons' young age had to be taken into consideration at sentencing. In January 2016, the court made the Miller decision retroactive. And so Jensen, in prison for 20 years, came up for a new hearing and argued that he had changed and should someday be allowed to leave prison. In June, Sixth Circuit presiding Judge John Brown heard testimony for 2 days and then issued a new sentence.
It'll be the sentence of the court here that he'll be sentenced to 200 years and for the murder of Michael Hare and kidnapping. The other term of year sentences that were imposed will remain in place, and any other conditions of his original sentence, all to be served concurrently.
Now Jensen will come up for parole for the first time in June 2021 when he's 39 years old. But that parole is not guaranteed. Jensen committed murder when an older system of parole was in place. Under those procedures, the parole board could turn Jensen down indefinitely. If he's not paroled, he's not eligible for good behavior release until he's 116 years old, and he doesn't flat time until long after that. In briefs filed with the court, Jensen's attorney, Jeff Larson, says the judge has the obligation under Miller to ensure that Jensen does not end up in prison for life. But Larson says Judge Brown handed that responsibility off to the parole board. If Jensen is not paroled, he won't live to be released in any other way. Larson says the parole board is an administrative body whose decisions are not subject to appeal, and it has no legal mandate to consider Jensen's young age at the time of the murder and other Miller factors. Larson refers to specific words the judge used in imposing the sentence, heard here at the June hearing. In this audio, you can also hear Paul Jensen crying into his microphone.
I was thinking that there's not very many people that are sentenced to the penitentiary for any period of time that have an opportunity to come back before the court after a period of significant period of time beyond the 2 years that's available and really have a full-blown resentencing hearing. And I said I thought that was unique, and then I kept thinking a little more about that. Actually, that's what our parole system is. Maybe this court doesn't sit as a parole board. The court probably isn't well equipped to perform that function.
In his brief, Larson says Judge Brown noted Jensen's progress in prison, but also seemed to stray from the intent of Miller.
It's not the same person before me that would have been before me back in 96. That doesn't eliminate the considerations of what took place, the circumstances of the crime that occurred at that time. Youth simply isn't an excuse or a way to excuse a criminal offense.
In the state's brief, Assistant Attorney General Ann Meyer points out that Judge Brown heard from psychologists, prison officials, and family and friends of both Jensen and his victim, Michael Hare. She says Judge Brown weighed the testimony to determine if Jensen could be rehabilitated, as well as considering retribution and deterrence. She refers to a section of the sentencing heard here.
And that, of course, is probably the primary function under the Miller factors for the court to consider, is whether there's been evidence or the possibility of rehabilitation.
Meyer says the Miller decision doesn't require that parole is certain, but only that it's possible. The state notes that an expert called by Jensen testified that the inmate would require close monitoring if he were released. The South Dakota Supreme Court will take up this case in late March and will issue its opinion at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
The Paul Dean Jensen case has been ongoing for more than 20 years with renewed court activity in recent years. SDPB has been covering it extensively and sent a team to Pierre in June for the resentencing. That past coverage with audio and photos, as well as today's South Dakota Supreme Court coverage, can be found online at listen.sdpb.org. Recent reports say child obesity numbers are holding steady after two decades. Today we talk about child obesity in South Dakota and what professionals and parents are doing to reverse the trend that puts an entire generation at risk. With me now on the phone for that conversation, we have Ashley Miller. She's a chronic disease epidemiologist with the Department of Health. Ashley Miller joining us via phone from Sioux Falls. Ashley, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
And also joining us via phone from Brandon is Karen Keezer. She's a health and PE specialist with the Department of Education. Karen Keezer, thanks for being here as well.
You're very welcome.
Let's start with some of the numbers. When we say those numbers are stagnant or they're holding steady, Ashley, that's not quite what the goal was it? We want to see those numbers go down.
That's right. We've set a South Dakota Department of Health, we set a goal of 14% obesity in school children by 2020. So in the past few years, as you've mentioned, we've seen it stagnate to about 16% of our kindergarten through 12th grade students being obese.
And so, what was it at its peak? How high up was it?
It's been about 16% the most recent years.
All right. So how did we get there, Ashley? When did we start tracking those numbers and noticing that there was a significant problem that needed to be addressed?
Right. So we started with the school height and weight report. We started collecting this information in the 1998 and 1999 school year. And then from there, we've tracked it every year, with the most recent year being the 2015 to 2016 school year. There was a change, however, in the definition of obesity around 2006 to 2007. So we really look at the numbers from 2006 to 2007 moving forward to see where we're at and how we've how our numbers, our obesity rates have changed.
So, Karen, it seems to me, and Ashley, I'm sure you have thoughts on this too, but when we're talking about kids from, you know, preschool to high school, their bodies are going to change on a monthly, sometimes overnight, you see your kid shoot up a little bit. So, Karen, how important is it to sort of look at the big picture when it comes to our children's weight?
Well, our goal with our school height and weight and for what we at the Department of Education, Department of Health are doing are to instill in our students healthy behaviors that can lead to, they can take into their adulthood life.
Okay. So it's the number tells us something, but the behavior is more important. Ashley, am I on the right track there, or we really need to focus on that number and say it's significant?
Well, I think the numbers are important because it does reflect where we're at currently. But I think, like Karen's saying, it will take a lot of effort of behavior change, nutrition, physical activity, all of these components working together to really see our numbers change. And so we'd love to see these healthy habits continue on into adulthood as well.
So, Ashley Miller, I just want to make sure we answer the basic question of why this matters, because sometimes it's hard to look far enough ahead to see the implications of this for a child, not only today, but in the future. So why does childhood obesity deserve the attention that we're giving it now?
Right. I think, you know, there's studies and statistics that say that kids that are obese or overweight in their youth are more likely to be overweight or obese in adulthood. And with obesity comes a lot of health problems, some chronic diseases. You're more prone to heart attack or stroke, for example, and other chronic diseases. And so thinking about a healthier lifestyle as we age, just keeping those in mind, we want to be healthy as we age as well.
How did those guidelines change in 2006, 2007, Ashley?
In terms of the definitions of obesity and overweight, they actually, prior to 2006, 2007, they defined obesity and overweight together. And then starting in 2006 to 2007, they separated them out so that your overweight became your 85th to 94th percentile on the scales, and then your obesity became that higher definition, higher category.
So, Karen Kieser, let's jump into what can be done to sort of reverse the trend. And what are some of the things that you're working on? Karen Kieser, if you're just joining us, is a health and PE specialist with the Department of Education. And Ashley Miller is a chronic disease epidemiologist with the Department of Health. So, Karen, let's talk about some of those actions and how you spread the word that translates into behavior changes.
Great. Two strategies actually have been identified by the Centers for Disease Control and are included in our work at the Departments of Education and Health. And we call them our priority areas, and that is what I work on. First of all, it's to promote the adoption of food service guidelines and nutrition standards in schools. And then secondly, to promote the adoption of physical education and physical activity in schools. And the way that I do this is by providing training to teachers, administrators, school food service personnel. I provide them technical assistance, and I provide evidence-based resources to help them understand what they can do within that school environment to make it a healthy school environment.
And as you get feedback, Karen, from teachers and food service personnel, what are you hearing some of the barriers are to those best practices?
Well, the biggest barrier is lack of time.
Right.
Maybe, you know, everybody's time is at a premium. So finding that champion within the school that will take on you know, maybe they're the physical activity leader or the local school wellness policy council leader, finding that champion, and then having that administrative support to propel that work forward. So the time, a lot of this doesn't take money per se, but you can get a little further if you have, you know, as a staff person perhaps, compensating them in some way.
Sure.
The other barrier, just acceptance these are the right things to do, these are the right strategies and the way to go about making these environmental changes within the school.
So, Karen, when I think of elementary school kids, I think of recess, and they have PE class every day, I think, or at least throughout the week. And then you get into that middle school and high school area, and some of those things go away. Are the challenges different as through different stages in a child's life?
They're very, very different. We see not only recess going away at the middle school and high school level in whatever way, shape, or form that takes place, but we are seeing a reduction in physical education offerings. It's not real bad at the middle school, but at the high school level, our students are only required to take a half a credit of PE in order to graduate. And with all the demands on their time, that is indeed all that many of our students are taking. So we really need to focus on that elementary level and get as far as we can with establishing these healthy behaviors so that they can carry them on into the middle school years, the high school years, adulthood, without a lot of effort.
Yeah. Ashley, do the numbers reflect that change over a child's, younger childhood to adolescence? Do you see numbers sort of telling us that the situation is different as they get older?
That's actually exactly what we see. When we break down our data, like from 5 to 8 year olds, obesity rate is 12.9%, but then it jumps in that 9 to 11 year old category to 17.9% of those 9 to 11 year olds being obese. And then once we get to the 15 to 19 year olds, 19% are obese.
Wow.
So we do see that as our kids are aging, that number, those obesity rates are increasing.
19% seems pretty significant. Not that the others' numbers are insignificant, but 19 sort of makes you gasp a little bit, doesn't it?
Yes.
Pushing 20%. How about some innovative solutions to this? Are we looking at the basics here? Are there ways to really think outside what we've already considered? Karen, do you want to address that? Do you see folks doing really innovative or unique approaches to adding more fitness or more nutritional guidelines into their schools throughout the state?
With our guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and with the efforts of the non-governmental organizations that CDC gives money to provide us with our resources, I think we can say we have they're very practical but innovative resources. First of all, the one resource that I'm charged with promoting is the Comprehensive School Physical Activity Program, and that is basically where we help schools to understand, realize, and implement the idea that students can get their 60 minutes of physical activity in throughout the day through recess, physical education, intramurals, sports, and then through physical activity in the classroom. Now, they're not new ideas by any means, but what we've got are resources to help them do that. The other new and exciting resource that just came out is through the CDC and then what's called Shape America, is a recess. It's called Strategies for Implementing Recess. And that might seem really simple to a lot of people, but we're seeing recess being taken away because of students are not getting their homework done or work done, and for poor behavior. So this resource helps schools by providing them with 19 evidence-based strategies for implementing recess. That recess is so integral to behavior change in students, helping them get their 60 minutes of physical activity in per day, staying on task in the classroom, just all of those things. It's just a very important piece of the student's day. Of course, we see recess mostly at the elementary level, but promoting that at the middle school level and at the high school level in some way, shape, or form is very important.
What does physical activity inside the classroom look like, Karen?
Physical activity in the classroom might be something as simple as pulling up something on YouTube. We have some resources. One of them is JAM or BAM or whatever that is promoted, where teachers can pull up maybe it's a music, and then students are demonstrating the movement to music, and it's very easily followed by the students within the classroom. Many teachers prefer pairing like math or spelling with the physical activity, like doing two jumping jacks plus 5 sit-ups equal what, or, times,
sure,
or minus or whatever. So taking those two content areas and bonding them together.
Well, it's a good day for recess today.
Yes,
every day is a good day for recess. But in South Dakota, I suppose the weather also kind of contributes to whether or not kids are going to get outside and how much they're going to move around when they're there. Ashley Miller, let's just close with this. How optimistic are you about watching those numbers sort of creep down in the future?
Right. I think if we continue to work collaboratively with the Department of Education and just really emphasizing to parents and across the state with our partners that it is important for us to reach this 14% goal to get these numbers to turn around, I do think that we can make it to that 14%.
Is there one thing that you want to leave parents with, Karen, that they can say, you know, they can contribute to this sort of process as well outside the school?
Well, I guess my first thought when I listen to you is that parents need to advocate within the school for these physical activity, physical education, recess, all of these types of activities. And they need to also advocate for, within the community, programs, whether it be the Little League baseball or the soccer or whatever, but advocating for programs like that, making our gyms open and available for parents and families beyond the school day. So they really do play a very big part in all of this.
Karen Kieser is a health and PE specialist with the Department of Education. Ashley Miller, a chronic disease epidemiologist with the Department of Health. Karen, thanks so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And Ashley, thanks for your time as well.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Laura Edwards has served South Dakotans as the SDSU Extension Climate Field Specialist since 2011. She was recently named the new SDSU Extension State Climatologist, a position previously held by Dennis Toddy. She joins us today via phone from Aberdeen. Laura Edwards, welcome back to In the Moment.
Hi, Lori. Great to be here.
I've been reading about you as you step into this new role, and you have a really interesting story about how you became interested in climate and weather to begin with, and it's not necessarily a cheerful one. So take me back to your childhood tornado experience.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I think a lot of my meteorology and weather friends might have a similar experience where it was a really significant weather event that made them interested in the weather. But yeah, I grew up in the Twin Cities area, and when I was about 9 years old, there was a tornado that came very close to our home within about a mile or two, and it was one of the first that was televised essentially live from a TV helicopter that was covering news at the time. And so it was one of those events where we were watching it on TV in our basement, the little black and white, and it was quite a moving experience for me. And ever since then, you know, even as a little girl, I had a rain gauge in my yard, and I would collect hailstones and do all those kinds of things, and I was really hooked on it from an early age.
Did you have a sense that it was kind of fear-related, that you were trying to control it, or were you just fascinated with the fact that you couldn't control it and you wanted to study it?
Yeah, I think it was more just fascination and just kind of being interested in science and trying to explain what happened there. And as it turns out, I never really did go into severe weather or forecasting. You know, as a climatologist, I didn't find climate really until I was in graduate school in Maryland, but it really is still interesting, but you won't find me chasing a tornado at this point. They have chased me, as it turns out.
Well, I don't suppose a nine-year-old really thinks about graduate school and climate study, so just briefly tell me about grad school and what pulled you in that direction then.
Yeah, so part of that fascination when I was younger, I had written a letter to the American Meteorological Society and asked what colleges offered degree programs.
I love that.
You know, I was kind of one of those kids, and they had suggested some schools, and so actually I got a bachelor's degree in physics at Minnesota just really so I could get into graduate school, and ended up at the University of Maryland, where I worked in the state climate office there, and that was really my entree, like how I got involved in state climatology and climate services, we call it, you know, serving our communities and all different people in our states that are interested in weather and climate.
Sure. So in this new role, you're very familiar with the territory, and then how is it? So what's the full scope of what you'll be doing now as state climatologist?
Yeah, so being an extension, there's kind of the obvious ones where I tie quite a bit with agriculture, both in cropping systems and livestock and also natural resource management. So those are probably the colleagues and the groups that I work most closely with, but also you know, working with some of our 4-H and youth programs and expanding, you know, weather and climate science, you know, in their activities as well. But being the state climatologist, too, it's representing the state more officially and working closely with the state agencies like natural resources and agriculture and those groups. And emergency management might be another obvious one, with drought especially. So, sure. You know, I'm really looking forward to the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead here, kind of in this new role.
So let's talk about what lies ahead in the month of March. I know you've got a March outlook coming out soon, but can you guide us through the first few weeks here of what to expect in the state?
Yeah, so the last official outlook that was released for March was a couple weeks ago. So at that time, they were looking at wetter than average conditions in most of western South Dakota. But I don't know if that's going to be the case now at this point, as it appears as if warm and drier climate is going to kind of take hold at least the first couple weeks in March. And it's kind of true for all the central and much of the southern plains, too, this whole large area of warm and dry conditions are probably going to move in starting, you know, at the end of this week, early next week. So it looks like we will start off March that way. One problem with that, though, is a lot of our winter wheat and some of our fruit trees and all those kinds of things are starting to come out of dormancy because we've been, you know, 6, 8, 10 degrees above average in February, really exceptionally warm. So I think we might run a risk of some hard frost or freeze issues later on in the spring. But we'll keep crossing fingers, and hopefully we won't have too bad of a problem here in South Dakota.
The sort of desire for, you know, warm, dry weather looks different depending on your profession and whether you just want to get outside for a while and enjoy it, or whether you've got that that crop going. I'm always been curious how you sort of gather that information. Can you give me an idea of what your day looks like?
Yeah, so a lot of it is looking at a lot of the computer climate models and kind of what they're saying. A lot of the models get updated once or twice a day. So I usually take a look in the afternoon for the next day or week ahead and kind of see what's going on there. And also working a lot with, again, my colleagues in Extension, and what might this mean for planning for spring, for example, for planting and fertilizing and all that kind of thing. What, you know, what might weeds or insects might we see emerge maybe earlier? As
sure.
For example, winter wheat might be coming out about a month earlier than usual. So what might that mean as far as risk to those farmers? And so it's kind of and a lot of people call me for information too and just ask me direct questions on what we're seeing and kind of what the forecast is. And so it's really interesting. A lot of different pieces come out in the course of a day, I guess.
And if you're just joining us, we're getting to know Laura Edwards. She is the state's new, state climatologist, SDSU Extension State Climatologist. Sorry about that. And Laura, as you step into this new position, I'm wondering what your sort of vision is or your plans for the future. Do you have things that you really think the state needs to do next?
Yeah, there's a couple things that are kind of on the horizon. There's a USDA climate hub, so kind of a regional group that's more focused on climate and agriculture and working with producers to plan for climate extremes, you know, droughts, floods, heat waves, that kind of thing. So we're kind of building that group across a six-state region here in the Northern Plains region. A couple other things I'm also working on is working with four tribes in South Dakota to help them plan better for drought management and water supply and water quality with some of the tribal entities in the state as well. So, and there's always an ongoing thing if we do have a drought, all of a sudden it gets really busy. So that's oftentimes in the summer when we see that.
How prepared are we as a state for extreme climate events?
Yeah, I think drought is one of the things that we're probably best prepared for, and that there is a group ready to go, ready to be called into action through PEER, through the Emergency Management and Department of Agriculture. And I also work very closely with the state fire meteorologist. That's Darren Klebo. He's at the School of Mines. And he and I visit probably weekly on weather and climate and drought issues, if there are. And so there's a lot of entities and kind of coordination. Another group that I work with quite a bit is the National Weather Service, and they have three offices in the state. And we look at climate with them, but also planning, like storm spotter trainings. How can we prepare the communities better for weather extremes?
Somebody's got to chase that tornado. That's a different kid who at the age of nine looked out the window and said, well, that's interesting. Yeah. Laura Edwards, it's great getting to know you. We hope to have you on the show in your new role frequently. Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist. Laura, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to get to Dr. Brett Bradfield here in a moment, hopefully. And in the meantime, SDPB's Keely Bultina is here with me at the University of Sioux Falls in the studio. Keely's had a busy morning. What's going on, Keely?
Well, as part of our team of reporters that are covering the legislative session this morning, I've been listening to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, which is ongoing right now. They're just transitioning to a bill that discusses some reforms in mental health. So we'll make sure to get to that because they plan to have a full hearing. So we'd like you to continue listening here. But if you really need to listen to that, they're just starting that in Senate Health and Human Services. They just finished a bill that they are sending to the floor and the full House, or I'm sorry, the full state Senate, that is House Bill 1191. And the full bill is not very long, but it's purpose is pretty widespread. So the bill actually reads that the Department of Social Services requires each person to cooperate with the Division of Child Support as a condition of eligibility. So when lawmakers are looking at this bill, they're trying to figure out how that short amount of time is going to, or that short sentence is going to take effect. So there are some people that say that having to provide information from the person who is going to is a non-custodial parent could be a problem and could create some major issues and bleed into custody battles. And the flip side of that is that lawmakers want to make sure that when they are having people apply for food stamps or the SNAP program, that no one is abusing that. So if there is another parent who is able to contribute financially to the kids, they want to make sure that that's possible. So the intent of the bill is to make sure that that happens. They say that there are exceptions if there's a situation where one parent may be abusive or they don't want to explain why that other parent might not be custodial. So there was some really emotional testimony this morning. And the bottom line was that the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, although the chair wasn't completely sure they had enough data, lawmakers say that this is something we should do because taxpayers should not be taking the burden of a parent who could be contributing to children financially and is choosing not to.
SDPB's Keely Bultino, remarkable as always. We'll let you get back to your work. You can always listen to those live at SDNet. You can download that as an app right on your phone. But Keely will give you the summary. So
just a couple of weeks left, guys.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Keely Bultino.
You're welcome.
And now with me in the studio, we're broadcasting live today from the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Joining me now, we have Dr. Brett Bradfield. He is the newly appointed President of USF. Welcome, sir. Glad to see you.
Thank you very much. Great to be here with you.
So you have quite a history with the University of Sioux Falls. Mm-hmm. Is there any part of it that you really haven't seen or worked in at this point? You came in 2000.
June of 2000, actually. And I believe I looked at this one day on the org chart, and I believe it. At any given time, I've had every operational unit of the university underneath me at some point.
Right. So, and so what does that do for you going forward with that depth of knowledge of this institution then?
Well, actually, it's been a tremendous benefit to me because our industry has changed radically, especially since 2009. And the days are kind of gone that you just need to understand one segment of your operation, because in higher education, everything matters. Everything feeds into the core mission of the institution. And so in many ways, you know, while people are always kind about the labor intensity of those duties, it's been a tremendous benefit to help me and to help the wonderful people I get the opportunity to work with to come to good solutions about how to deal with the future. So it's been a good experience.
You began with what sort of focus when you first came? More of an adult learning and expanding the footprint of the graduate program, as
correct.
I understand it?
Yep. My first role here, it was really quite unplanned. I was being courted a little bit by South Dakota State University and USD. In fact, I was an applicant for positions there. I got offered two positions, and then USF just kind of came out of nowhere, quite honestly. And I met one day about a possibility of a new position at the university called Director of Graduate Programs, and that was kind of the start of things. At that time, there was at least an expressed desire for the university to explore more into the adult learning market and increase its footprint that way. And so that was my early roots here at USF.
And how did you sort of tackle that that challenge? Because that's a big challenge in Sioux Falls, I'm guessing.
It is a big challenge, but I want to make sure I give due credit to people that were before me. It wasn't that we started from zero. Mm-hmm. There were already existing programs here, an MBA, a DCP, a grad ed program. Really focused on the grad ed programs early on. And we have a tremendous following here in the Sioux Falls area and the surrounding region in that area. And we were just able to have some really good success to grow those areas. And then in 2004, the president at that time, Mark Benedetto, who just retired, came to me about a vision he had for a cabinet-level position, co-dean with the regular dean of academic affairs. And he called the position vice president for professional studies. And after some reflection and thought, I applied for the position. I was fortunate enough to get it. And for those 2 years, then, we had some great success growing programs here at the university and our footprint. And again, I'd be remiss if I didn't give credit to a lot of wonderful, talented people, some of that are still here, that really helped with that effort.
So I'm the parent of a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And the two things that she's not quite there to the college application level yet, but the two things that are top of my mind as a mother is student debt and violence on campus against mm-hmm. Young women. And these are both things that you have an interest in as well, I'm sure, as the
yes.
president of the University of Sioux Falls. Mm-hmm. Let's start with violence against women, because you pursued and received a grant at some point. So talk to me, is that something I should be worried about as the parent of a future college student, I hope?
Well, you know, we exist in a world of young adults. And any of us that remember that time in our lives also know it's a time of questioning and experimentation. And, you know, one of the things I think we do very well here at the University of Sioux Falls is we attend to those kinds of developmental issues. recognizing that our students are in that place of life. The unfortunate things that you hear about around the nation, the violence issues against women in particular, have been things that have been kind of silent on campuses and now have all of a sudden come to the forefront, which I look at as a positive advancement in our enterprise because, you know, part of educating the whole person, to steal from a tagline we had just a few years ago, is that we are here obviously for academic disciplines that get you on to a major and perhaps specified kinds of licensure opportunities, etc. But another part of our hidden curriculum, as I often call it, is how we behave to become productive citizens, to become good husbands, wives, parents, to become ethical community members and ethical in our business practices. And quite honestly, as part of our Christian mission at this place, how we treat our fellow human beings. And that speaks very deeply to the need for respect discussions, parameters of behavior. And we work very, very hard at that, still understanding there will be those times that young people just slip. They just do. It's part of the growing up process that probably all of us have experienced. So we have a very active student development area that has been working very hard on those areas. We consciously talk about these things. We don't hide it, and we try to deal with it very forward on our campus.
Sure. And if there is an incident, I'm guessing that's viewed as something more than just a young person slipping. It must
Absolutely.
Be viewed pretty seriously. So
very, very seriously. In fact, even if we didn't want it that way, there is federal compliance now that requires sure. reporting. But we have an ethical responsibility to deal with those issues in a manner that's appropriate. And sometimes that includes law enforcement, and sometimes it includes a campus meeting with counselors or other people. But we very much consider it a significant part of our role here at the University of Sioux Falls.
Let's talk about that college debt, because I think we'll be talking about it for yeah. a long time until there's some relief. It has completely changed since I went to college. Mm-hmm. So how do incoming students and their parents sort of approach that conversation now?
Well, you know, no matter where you go around the nation, for-profit, non-profit, public, non-public, private Christian like we are, it is the discussion of the moment, which is, do we provide something that has a return of investment? And, you know, to be honest, the federal government's involvement in recent years is centered deeply around loan debt. Guess what? When the federal government gets involved and they provide subsidization for loans, they have an interest in those loans being paid back. And so I think in many ways, our industry has started to look at college education, college degrees as more of a commodity, a means to an end. A lot of us in academia don't like that.
Right.
We believe still that that learning should be a gift in itself. But the realistic part of us, the business side of us, also understands there is an expectation there. We work very hard in this private setting through both funded and unfunded scholarships to make this an affordable alternative. But I never lose sight, especially of our location in South Dakota, where in many cases tuition is now outrunning the median income of many of our families. If you have multiple children, you know, it can be daunting to look at that. And the one thing that none of us want is for our children to leave college with suffocating debt, the kind of debt that prevents them from having some quality of life, perhaps a place of their own, a vehicle to drive, the ability to just live semi-comfortably. So I think, you know, I wish I had top-notch solutions for that right at this moment, but I just came from a meeting, a high-level executive meeting here of our group on campus, talking really about this very thing and how we keep it affordable, yet have enough to make sure we can operate. And so there's a lot of challenges in that conversation.
Right. So how energized are those conversations? It seems very urgent as a parent, and particularly urgent as an institution as well.
It is, because, you know, I never lose sight of the fact that when we have families come here, You know, for most of us that are parents, and you're being one, just as you mentioned, education almost becomes a non-negotiable.
Right.
But, you know, in South Dakota, in this region, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say this. We have a great education system. We don't have people running from the public institutions because they're bad. In fact, they're very good quality institutions. We believe we are, too, and we believe we have something extra to offer because of our identity. But it's a very competitive marketplace.
Right.
And, so when we have families here and young men and women looking at our institution, you know, part of our task is to develop the kind of relationship where they see value in spending money and perhaps taking on some loan debt. But we're also, as I said, very sensitive to the idea that we certainly don't want to see them have suffocating loan debt. And we do very well in that area. I mean, statistically, when you look at us across the breadth of schools in the region, our students come out, I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was like around $24,000, $25,000 of debt on average. And that's still a lot of debt, but
it's peanuts, what you keep hearing about.
Yes, it is. It is. And we are continuing to work very hard to that.
It's not peanuts. I'm just saying you're starting to hear some really terrifying numbers as parents. You have four kids. You've
absolutely
been through this or are going through it at some point,
sure,
sort of having those conversations in your own family as
yep
well. Very briefly, we've just got about a minute left.
Sure.
And I heard a rumor that some of your future was planned out on the back of a napkin. Do you want to tell that story and tell me if it's true or if I've been led astray by the napkin story?
Well, I don't know which part of that is, but if you're talking about my first meeting with Mark.
Okay. Benedetta, I don't know. Like I said,
it took place at Bagel Boy on 26th Street, actually. And it was at that time that there was an expression of Mark and the then VP at that time, Nancy Coolidge, about this dream, this vision of adult learning growing.
Sure.
And that was kind of the start of the dream. I guess I've had, if I look back reflectively on my career, building things has always been a big part of that and improving things that already existed. And so it was a great opportunity for me to kind of diagram that and chart it out. So
great things begin in small little squares of paper.
They certainly
and small
do
conversations.
They certainly do.
Just over a cup of coffee and a bagel.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Dr. Brett Bradfield is the new president of the University of Sioux Falls. And I want to say thank you so much for your time today, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Come back again and talk higher education with us.
Absolutely.
Especially
I would love
as
to
you
do
figure
it
out how to solve this student debt
I will
conundrum
do that for you. You just let me know. Thank you very much.